Chapter 46. Above all, that the burden of that horrible death would lie forever on his soul. He was lashing himself to fury with his own words as he spoke, and I stood leaning against the wall opposite to him, cold, dumb, unresisting, when suddenly my father interrupted. I think that both Jack and I had forgotten his presence, but at the sound of his voice, changed from what we had ever heard it, we turned to him, and I then for the first time saw in his face the death look which never afterwards quitted it. "Stop, Jack," apostrophe he said. "Alan is not to blame, and if it had not been in this way, it would have been in some other. I only am guilty, who brought you both into existence with my own hell-stained blood in your veins. If you wish to curse anyone, curse your family, your name, me if you will, and may God forgive me, that you were ever born into the world." Apostrophe, Alan stopped with a shudder, and then continued, dully, "It was when I heard those words, the most terrible, that a father could have uttered, that I first understood all that old 16th century tale might mean to me and mine. I have realized it vividly enough since. Early the next morning, when the dawn was just breaking, Jack came to the door of my room, to bid me goodbye. All his passion was gone. His looks and tones seemed part and parcel of the dim gray morning light. He freely withdrew all the charges he had made against me the night before, forgave me all the share that I had had in his misfortunes, and then begged that I would never come near him, or let him hear from me again. The curse is heavy upon us both, apostrophe he said, and it is the only favor which you can do me. Apostrophe I have never seen him since. But you have heard of him," I exclaimed. "What has become of him?" Alan raised himself to a sitting posture. "The last that I heard," he said, with a catch in his voice, "was that in his misery and hopelessness he was taking to drink. George writes to him, and does what he can, but I dare not say a word, for fear it should turn to poison on my lips. I dare not lift a hand to help him, for fear it should have power to strike him to the ground. The worst may be yet to come. I am still living, still living. There are depths of shame to which he has not sunk. And oh, Evie, Evie, he is my own, my best loved brother." All his composure was gone now. His voice rose to a kind of wail with the last words, and folding his arms on his raised knee, he let his head fall upon them, while his figure quivered with scarcely restrained emotion. There was a silence for some moments, while he sat thus, I looking on in wretched helplessness beside him. Then he raised his head, and, without looking round at me, went on in a low tone. "And what is in the future? I pray that death instead of shame may be the portion of the next generation, and I look at George's boys, only to wonder which of them is the happy one who shall someday lie dead at his brother's feet. Are you surprised at my resolution never to marry? The fatal prophecy is rich in its fulfillment. None of our name and blood are safe, and the day might come when I too should have to call upon my children to curse me for their birth, should have to watch while the burden which I could no longer bear alone pressed the life from their mother's heart." Through the tragedy of this speech I was conscious of a faint suggestion of comfort, a far-off glimmer, as of unseen home lights on a midnight sky. I was in no mood then to understand, or to seek to understand, what it was, but I know now that his words had removed the weight of helpless banishment from my spirit, that his heart, speaking through them to my own, had made me for life the sharer of his grief. Presently he drew his shoulders together with a slight determined jerk, threw himself back upon the grass, and turning to me, with that tremulous, haggard smile upon his lips which I knew so well, but which had never before struck me with such infinite pathos, "Luckily," he said, "there are other things to do in life besides being happy. Only perhaps you understand now what I meant last night when I spoke of things which flesh and blood cannot bear, and yet which must be borne." Suddenly and sharply his words roused again into activity the loathsome memory which my interest in his story had partially deadened. He noticed the quick involuntary contraction of my muscles, and read it aright. That reminds me, he went on. I must claim your promise. I have told you my story. Now, tell me yours. I told him, not as I have said it down here, though perhaps even in greater detail, but incoherently, bit by bit, while he helped me out with gentle questions, quickly comprehending gestures, and patient waiting during the pauses of exhaustion which perforce interposed themselves. As my story approached its climax, his agitation grew almost equal to my own, and he listened to the close, his teeth clenched, his brows bent, as if passing again with me through that awful conflict. When I had finished, it was some moments before either of us could speak, and then he burst forth into bitter self-reproach for having so far yielded to his brother's angry obstinacy, as to allow me to sleep the third night in that fatal room. It was cowardice, he said, sheer cowardice. After all that has happened, I dared not have a quarrel with one of my own blood. And yet if I had not hardened my heart, I had reason to know what I was risking. How do you mean? I asked. Those other two girls who slept there, he said, breathlessly. It was in each case after the third night there, that they were found dead, Evie, so runs the story, with a mark upon their necks similar in shape and position to the death wound which Margaret Mervyn inflicted upon herself. I could not speak, but I clutched his hand with an almost convulsive grip. And I knew the story, I knew it, he cried. As boys we were not allowed to hear much of our family traditions, but this one I knew. When my father redid the interior of the east room, he removed at the same time a board from above the doorway outside, on which had been written, it is said by Dame Alice herself, a warning upon this very subject. I happened to be present when our old housekeeper, who had been his nurse, remonstrated with him warmly upon this act, and I asked her afterwards what the board was, and why she cared about it so much. In her excitement she told me the story of those unhappy girls, repeating again and again that, if the warning were taken away, evil would come of it. And she was right, I said, dully. Oh, if only your father had left it there. I suppose, he answered, speaking more quietly, that he was impatient of traditions which, as I told you, he at that time more than half despised. Indeed he altered the shape of the doorway, raising it, and making it flat and square, so that the old inscription could not have been replaced, even had it been wished. I remember it was fitted round the low Tudor arch which was previously there. My mind, too worn with many emotions for deliberate thought, wandered on languidly, and as it were mechanically, upon these last trivial words. The doorway presented itself to my view as it had originally stood, with the discarded warning above it, and then, by a spontaneous comparison of mental vision, I recalled the painted board which I had noticed 3 days before in Dom Alice's tower. I suggested to Alan that it might have been the identical one, its shape was as he described. Very likely, he answered, absently. Do you remember what the words were? Yes, I think so, I replied. Let me see. And I repeated them slowly, dragging them out as it were one by one from my memory. Where the woman sinned, the maid shall win, but God help the maid that sleeps within. You see, I said, turning towards him slowly, the last line is a warning such as you spoke of. But to my surprise Alan had sprung to his feet, and was looking down at me, his whole body quivering with excitement. Yes, Evie, he cried, and the first line is a prophecy, where the woman sinned the maid is one. He seized the hand which I instinctively reached out to him. We have not seen the end of this yet, he went on, speaking rapidly, and as if articulation had become difficult to him. Come, Evie, we must go back to the house, and look at the cabinet now, at once. I had risen to my feet by this time, but I shrank away at those words. To that room? Oh, Alan, no, I cannot. He had hold of my hand still, and he tightened his grasp upon it. I shall be with you. You will not be afraid with me, he said. Come. His eyes were burning, his face flushed and paled in rapid alternation, and his hand held mine like a vice of iron. I turned with him, and we walked back to the Grange, Alan quickening his pace as he went, till I almost had to run by his side. As we approached the dreaded room, my sense of repulsion became almost unbearable, but I was now infected by his excitement, though I but dimly comprehended its cause. We met no one on our way, and in a moment he had hurried me into the house, up the stairs, and along the narrow passage, and I was once more in the East Room, and in the presence of all the memories of that accursed night. For an instant I stood strengthless, helpless, on the threshold, my gaze fixed panic-stricken on the spot where I had taken such awful part in that phantom tragedy of evil. Then Alan threw his arm round me, and drew me hastily on in front of the cabinet. Without a pause, giving himself time neither to speak nor think, he stretched out his left hand, and moved the buttons one after another. How or in what direction he moved them I know not, but as the last turned with a click, the doors, which no mortal hand had unclosed for 300 years, flew back, and the cabinet stood open. I gave a little gasp of fear. Alan pressed his lips closely together, and turned to me with eager questioning in his eyes. I pointed in answer tremblingly at the drawer which I had seen open the night before. He drew it out, and there on its satin bed lay the dagger in its silver sheath. Still without a word he took it up, and reaching his right hand round me, for I could not now have stood had he withdrawn his support, with a swift strong jerk he unsheathed the blade. There in the clear autumn sunshine I could see the same dull stains I had marked in the flickering candlelight, and over them, still ruddy and moist, were the drops of my own half-dried blood. I grasped the lapel of his coat with both my hands, and clung to him like a child in terror, while the eyes of both of us remained fixed, as if fascinated upon the knife blade. Then, with a sudden start of memory, Alan raised his to the cornice of the cabinet, and mine followed. No change that I could detect had taken place in that twisted gold work, but there, clear in the sight of us both, stood forth the words of the magic motto. Pure blood shed by the blood-stained knife ends Mervyn shame, heals Mervyn strife. In low steady tones Alan read out the lines, and then there was silence on my part of stunned bewilderment, the bewilderment of a spirit overwhelmed beyond the power of comprehension by rushing, conflicting emotions. Alan pressed me closer to him, while the silence seemed to throb with the beating of his heart, and the panting of his breath. But except for that he remained motionless, gazing at the golden message before him. At length I felt a movement, and looking up saw his face turned down towards mine, the lips quivering, the cheeks flushed, the eyes soft with passionate feeling. "We are saved, my darling," he whispered. "Saved, and through you." Then he bent his head lower, and there in that room of horror, I received the first long lover's kiss from my own dear husband's lips. My husband, yes, but not till some time after that. Alan's first act, when he had once fully realized that the curse was indeed removed, was throwing his budding practice to the winds, to set sail for America. There he sought out Jack, and labored hard to impart to him some of his own newfound hope. It was slow work, but he succeeded at last, and only left him when, 2 years later, he had handed him over to the charge of a bright-eyed Western girl, to whom the whole story had been told, and who showed herself ready and anxious to help in building up again the broken life of her English lover. To judge from the letters that we have since received, she has shown herself well fitted for the task. Among other things, she has money, and Jack's worldly affairs have so prospered that George declares that he can well afford now to waste some of his superfluous cash upon farming a few of his elder brother's acres. The idea seems to smile upon Jack, and I have every hope this winter of being able to institute an actual comparison between our small boy, his namesake, and his own 3-year-old Alan. The comparison, by the way, will have to be conditional, for Jack, at the name by which my son and heir is familiarly known, is but a little more than 2. I turn my eyes for a moment, and they fall upon the northern corner of the East Room, which shows round the edge of the house. Then the skeleton leaps from the cupboard of my memory. The icy hand which lies ever near my soul grips it suddenly with a chill shudder. Not for nothing was that wretched woman's life interwoven with my own, if only for an hour. Not for nothing did my spirit harbor a conflict and an agony, which, thank God, are far from its own story. Though Margaret Mervyn's dagger failed to pierce my flesh, the wound in my soul may never wholly be healed. I know that that is so, and yet as I turn to start through the sunshine to the cedar shade and its laughing occupants, I whisper to myself with fervent conviction, it was worth it. End of Project Gutenberg Text, The Lock and Key Library, Hawthorne, ed. Gilby, Gutenberg Edition.